All right, well, welcome back to Sheep Stuff You Should Know. I'm Dan Makin today, coming from Auburn, California, where winter has returned, at least for the last couple of days. And I am joined today by Danielle Dooney. Did I get that pronounced right?
Dooney.
Dooney, darn it. Yeah, you told me that, and I butchered it anyway, so sorry about that.
It's okay.
Thank you for joining us.
I need to change my last name anyhow. I just got married, so.
Very cool. Very cool. So this is like a multi-state podcast today. Tell me where you are today and introduce yourself if you would.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I'm really honored to be here. I've listened to this podcast a lot and seen some of the legends on here. So I'm glad to join them with my name on there. Right now I'm sitting at my house in Livingston, Montana. I kind of have a background all over the West, roots in Colorado, come from a long line of Basque people that raise sheep in Wyoming. I went and got my undergrad and at a small school in Colorado, down in the southwest corner of the state, Fort Lewis. And then I ended up at, well, I did it, it worked for a while, went, did an internship on the Harper feedlot in northern Colorado. They have
cool.
A bunch of sheep,
yeah.
A couple cows, and ended up at grad school at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces, studying site-adapted livestock and desert cattle for a range master's. During that time, I had finished all my classes, and I was just writing, as we say, which is really quite a big task. It's not just writing. And
the bulk of your master's, right?
Yeah. Right, yeah. Yeah. But I often hear, I just have to write. And it really is a lot more than that. So I ended up applying for a job, the livestock foreman job at the Montana State University Ag Stations in Bozeman. And my now husband and I moved to Fort Ellis, which is a super cool old cavalry fort that sits on a section. So 604 acres, with a great house and kind of the sheep operation for the bucks and developing rams for the Montana ram sale. And then I was able to work at the Bart farm and run the lambing barn at Red Bluff for a couple of years out in Norris. Got a lot of great experience there and really found my niche with sheep. It's in my blood. I was a warm Basque body when they needed someone to take care of the sheep. So
very
seemed
cool.
It seemed like a good fit.
Yeah.
And then I had a great run there. And a job came open with NCAT, National Center for Appropriate Technology, out of Butte, Montana, to work on a climate smart commodity grant for the Climate Beneficial Fiber Partnership. So I'm a technical service provider for that. And I'm really excited to beginning that work. We have a lot of money to give out to producers, and we're hoping to open up some markets for wool for people that are, you know, implementing specific land practices. And we work all over the nation on this project, but my region is specifically Wyoming, Montana, and South Dakota. So we consider ourselves the Northern Great Plains, and we have a great team. It's been really, really fun. Lots of things to figure out, but awesome opportunity to work with producers and boots on the ground assistance.
That's awesome. So with that big a territory, how much variation is there in sheep breeds and kind of production types and production scale? Are you working with really small on it to really big producers?
Yeah, that's a great question. We are specifically working with fine white wool producers. So okay. Our target is 19 to 22.4 micron, okay. Thinking that that's the commodity scale wool. And that's what we're on the partnership for climate smart commodities. And so understanding that if there's a coarser wool, their probably commodity is going to be meat. Mm-hmm. We work. Yeah, we really have a wide range of places. We see some smaller outfits in South Dakota, and then, you know, Wyoming holds it down with some pretty big range operations.
Yeah.
We're seeing the difference of these systems of having rangeland or grazing allotments, and how that works. We're able to do a lot of work on private ground right now. It's harder to implement these climate smart practices on your leased ground or your federal and state.
Yeah. What kinds of practices are people looking at? What kinds of things are you helping them do, in that regard?
A big one that we're interested in, just because of the seasonality right now, it's April, so we're focusing on cover crop.
Okay.
Have some producers doing some innovative stuff with interseeding and making their own seed mixes. Most of that cover crop then gets used for backgrounding lambs or flushing ewes, as well as increasing their soil health and increasing the productivity of the overall ranch. Later, and we just stepped into year two of the project, and so it's a 5-year project. In the coming years, most people are interested in water. That seems to
Yeah.
be their limiting factor. It's like, I could graze that, or if I just didn't have to haul water, there's a lot that could be changed and done. So we're looking at ways, portable water systems, pipelines, things like that to increase efficiency as well as productivity.
Okay. And are these cost share programs, or are these practices that so you provide technical assistance on the practice and then also some cost share?
Yep, exactly. We are cost sharing, and we provide that technical assistance. It's based on landowner goals. So the producers I'm working with, it's really what works for them. What are they interested in doing? What do they have the time and labor to implement? And then I advocate for us moving those practices forward within our program. Once we do that, they have the opportunity. We're working on getting these markets developed. We're working with FiberShed and the Carbon Cycle Institute in California,
Yeah.
writing ranch plans and then opening up these wool markets. So our goal is to push, I'd be cautious saying how many pounds, but some pounds through these markets of premium. So we hope that, a brand, where we're trying to identify brands. So we're really working on the textile
Okay.
aspect, and that the brands would be looking for specific wool, kind of that has a story and has some land management behind it. As I know, I do preface, I like to say whenever I start talk about this project is we understand and I understand, it doesn't get much more sustainable than wool, right? We have a multi-crop animal. It is climate beneficial. It just happens. We raise it, shear it, handle it well. So all wool meets those criteria, if you will. But we're working with specific producers to just try to elevate that message.
And so in doing that, is there some sort of a certification that goes with their wool when it goes to a potential buyer that can follow through the value chain that way?
It's a great question. Yeah, we are not as ranch comprehensive, I would say, as RWS and AWA
Okay.
certifications.
Okay.
We're really just looking at the land management at
Okay.
this point.
Okay.
And FiberShed is the developing that certification that's still being developed. What we know right now is that it's at least one, you're implementing at least one practice, and other than that, it's kind of in development, so I can't really say much more. But
Cool to be in on the front end of it, though.
oh, it's thrilling. Yeah, we get to wear all sorts of different hats, and it's exciting. It's innovative.
I bet. I bet. One of the things I'm curious about, and I know this is that my perspective on this is fairly narrow to my part of California, but I think externally there's this perception out there that ranchers don't think much of the term climate change or climate smart, and yet a lot of the ranchers that I work with, at all scales and kind of beginning ranchers on up to multi-generation. If you sit down and talk to them, they say, yeah, the climate is changing and we are trying to adapt to it. We don't get into to where the where's or why's so much, but I think anybody that's working outside and working with Mother Nature knows that there are changes happening. What's your experience with the ranchers that you work with in your three states?
Yeah, I would say our ranchers and just ranchers in general, they know more about what's going on with the weather and the changes that that causes, and how that's influenced plant communities. Or, oh, it, I was just talking to a rancher, and he's like, we usually shear on the 3rd week of March because it's a weather break, and we had to push it up this year, and it did clear on that 3rd week of March, so.
Yeah.
They know what's going on, and it's just mindset. I'm happy to meet anyone where they're at.
Yeah.
It's our principles are really soil health, productivity. We come from a carbon framework, because that is the basis of all life. But we kind of tread lightly there, and
Yeah. 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 It really seems here in this part of the West that folks are looking for new ways to do things, or looking for ways to better understand the benefits of what they've always done too. I think that's a piece of it too, right? Is that ranchers have for generations taken great care of their landscapes and their animals, and now there's some ways to be able to acknowledge that, hopefully in the marketplace ultimately.
Yeah, that is the goal, and we understand that, the rancher's always going to be the expert on their place, and they're usually up against weather, inputs, labor,
Yep.
as
Yep.
their main and predators. I can't forget
Yep.
predators.
Yep. So, in light of that, when you're working with ranchers, what are some of the other issues in your part of the West that people talk about as there as things they wish they could solve, or things that are frustrating in that regard?
You talk to anyone in Wyoming right now, and it's predators and land management
Yeah.
issues on state and federal ground.
Yeah.
That seems to be a really big issue, and most people just want to sell their wool at this point. We're talking a premium would be nice, but if you could sell the last 2 years of my wool, I could clean my barn out, and my
Yeah.
son could have his wedding party in here,
Yeah.
So could
Yeah.
you get the wool sold by June 15th?
No pressure, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's mostly what we see, because the predators are taking out, lambs left and right, and that requires increase in labor, and that's just harder to get with wages going up across the board. So similar problems, I would think. What do you guys see in your part of the world?
Well, I think very similar. I think California now has joined the Club of Western States with gray wools, and so navigating that and learning from producers in states that have had them for much longer than we have has been an issue. Labor continues to be an issue, and California in particular, we've had some laws passed in the last 5 years that create new overtime rules in agriculture, which have been challenging for people that have herders employed, for sure. And so that comes up a lot. Everybody talks about the 2 or 3 years worth of wool that they've got in storage, and so, whether it's coarse wool or fine wool, that's always comes up too. But now, are you working with, or is FiberShed working with some of the big wool marketers like Roswell or Utah Wool or any of those outfits as well in this project?
Well, at this point, we are working with anyone and everyone that wants to try to help us out. So we have some partners like the New York Textile Lab in New York. So they're really helpful on the design front, as well as they have started their own wool pool and they're implementing practices. And we have FiberShed. So we're really kind of thinking of this nationwide. And we're just in the R&D, a new term I've learned. We're in the research and development phase of our project. And so right now we're just kind of understanding what are the different avenues that wool can go through, and what are the bottlenecks, and who might come into the players as solutions. So I got the joy to tour Chargeurs just a couple weeks
Oh,
ago. I
wow.
visiting South Carolina to visit a friend and had her drive me 3 hours to Jamestown, so we could chat with Diego, and boy, was that really interesting.
I'll bet. I'll bet. I'll bet 3 hours in the Carolinas is not like 3 hours in Wyoming, right? You cover most of the state that way.
Yeah, it was a long drive, but beautiful and really cool to see all that in production.
Yeah, I bet. I'll bet. Very cool. What are some of the first questions that ranchers ask you when you make contact? What's kind of where what are they curious about learning?
Well, when can you sell my wool? And is step one, and kind of what do I need to do to be in the program? And what can you do for me, kind of thing. I think we're in an interesting time right now with a lot of this funding that's come down, where it seems like there was a lot of everyone kind of made a lot of projections on acreages, and so we want to make sure that if ranchers are working with us, we're the best fit for them, and can really meet their goals. But they're curious about mostly how to increase their productivity. How can I not ship my lambs 4 hours away for the summer and keep them on the place? And if we could develop water and get some fence going, I can do some more smaller pastures and targeted grazing, and not have to, anytime we can not put them on a truck, I think that your inputs go down. They're really interested too in having a network of people that are doing other things that they are. And so they want to say, hey, did I need a 14 seed mix, or can I get by with three? What's a good way to plant this? And we're kind of, have some people interested in the wool pellets. So looking at, different applications of those, and kind of how do we get some more research and standardize what's going on there. It seems to be new. So what's an application rate? What do you spread it with? How do you get it in a pellet form? Different types of pelletizers. So we're really interested in that as well.
We're starting to see some of that out here, and I've actually, I call it, I've invested my last 3 years worth of wool in somebody that's trying to develop a wool mulch market with pelletized wool. But I think for the coarse wools, that could be a huge opportunity, right?
Bellies, yeah, tags.
So specifically, what breeds are you working with? Is it mostly Rambouillet, Western Whiteface type ewes, or
Yeah, we have, that Mountain Merino, Rambouillet, Targhee, a lot of Targhees in Montana. Western Whiteface, yeah, you nailed it. And we see flock sizes vary. We have folks that still have a couple of bands, and then down to a couple hundred, and so.
Are there very many new producers in those states? Are there people coming to sheep new?
That's interesting. We have one or two newer producers, but we're really trying, my colleagues and I, of how do we reach these younger producers? Because this program would be really beneficial. And sometimes, we joke, wait, maybe we should go buy some sheep and try to figure out how to be in this program. And actually trying to track down some of those producers, I ended up on the steering committee for the Young and Emerging Entrepreneurs through ASI.
Yeah,
And so
cool.
hoping that we can kind of get into that and ho hopefully help those folks. Sometimes we work with an interesting demographic when you're working with sheep people. They're a lot of century ranchers, been around a long time if they're still in the sheep business. And sometimes these programs just aren't quite their cup of tea. And so finding people that are really excited to be in it and really want to participate, and we could really help, because it is big money.
It's interesting in California, kind of that dichotomy that there are, I think sheep are kind of the gateway livestock in California. They're easier than cows, they're cheaper than cows. If we can convince people to get started, they're typically pretty enthusiastic and excited about it. But then finding those people and getting them engaged in industry networks is challenging because they're new to the industry in general too, I think.
Yeah, and keeping the wool breed alive, as it requires, more management, shearing, things like that, which can be hard to nail down. So I think that's a really exciting part that we can work on through this project as well, is, hopefully by elevating some producers and the wool premiums for their wool, we can show that it is still a really cool thing to be a part of. And it's, my grandma says wool's the best fabric and fiber around, so we all love it, and it's just important that we understand that someone's got to produce it.
You
So
know, we've talked about that on this podcast before too, that it's so unique that every wool garment starts with somebody doing work by hand. And that's so unusual in the 21st century, I think, to even contemplate that. Are you guys doing anything in terms of supporting infrastructure and supporting kind of the shearing skill building that is necessary to make sure we can still get wool off a sheep?
not through this program. I know that Fibershed is working on, thinking about what building a mill or looking at, increased ways of processing. And then in Montana, we have a great extension program that puts on, we have shearing schools come through multiple times. Actually, there was just a wool handling school yesterday during the MSU shearing, and
Oh,
so had a
cool.
couple of people there working the floor, skirting fleeces, running the baler. And
Cool.
so I think it's an ongoing education opportunity.
And Montana's building a new wool lab too, right?
They are, yeah. So they've broken ground, and hopefully that keeps rocking and rolling. I'm sure it will. And it was a feat to get the money raised. There was a lot of industry support, and so I know that's been really helpful.
That's very cool. So I want to transition to your time in New Mexico, and so I assume you worked at the College Ranch and out on the Jornada in your project.
Yes, correct. I worked with my advisor was Dr. Andre Sibbles, and so really, really honored to work with him. We were on a client, well, we were on a Southwest Sustainable Beef Grant looking at the Rarámuri Criollo, and they are from the Copper Canyon of Mexico, horned, smaller framed, all different colors, different hides. And what we were looking at was the difference in diet, as well as travel distance that they would go from water, slope. Our lab was also looking at other different mothering characteristics. It was a cool grant, and it's almost come to a completion. But we had partners in, I was specifically working with the Dugout Ranch, as well as the College Ranch. The Dugout Ranch is in Utah, so really steep canyon country, good fit for site-adapted livestock, desert on that Colorado plateau. We were working with people, producers in California, South Dakota, so seeing how they perform in different environments. Really interesting work, and collared cows, and I'd sit in the desert and mark if they were browsing, grazing, walking, resting, which when you're in Las Cruces, New Mexico, if you want to catch cattle grazing, you better be out long before the sun comes up. If you show up around 7:30 in the summer, they're at water.
They're shaded up or in the at the water trough. What, so how do you define climate adapted livestock? What are the things that whether it's sheep or cows or goats, we need to think about in terms of our own climate and how they're adapted.
A term that kind of comes out of the MSU crew is high output, low input. So, we're looking at animals that perform well in the environment that they're given.
So they're going to tell you if they're climate adapted.
Exactly. Yeah, we keep we I think just by looking at, your birth weights or your overall performance, how they maintain body condition score. It's going to let you know if they're a good fit. Demeanor, right? Temper all goes a long way. But I think that's really key there, is that high high output with lower inputs. Now, you might need to give them a little bit of energy or a lick tub. We're not saying that don't give them anything. But just looking at with the especially with the Criollo, they were smaller framed. So on the similar land you could run, you could increase your stocking rate. And I think that's really key. There's still some economic development that needs to be looked at there on, well, if you're increasing stocking rate now, you have another tag, another vaccine, another head on a truck. So does it really pencil out? But that's really where our sheep come in, right? We can run a heck of a lot more sheep than cows, and they work well together.
That's the kind of the rule of thumb that a lot of people out here use, is that you can add one ewe to your cattle operation and not have to decrease. You can add as many ewes as you have cows and still keep the same number of cows.
As long as you're managing them, right? We see they like to pace around that fence line pretty hard, and
So
so.
back to the Southwest Beef Project, one of the questions I've had in that project, and I think it's part of our challenge in the sheep industry, is kind of how we match up what makes sense from a production standpoint with what the market wants to buy. What size ribeye does the market demand? All of those questions. And so how do we balance that as producers and listening to our landscapes, but also having a product that somebody wants to pay us for?
That's a loaded question.
That's the question.
if I could solve that, yeah, we'd have it all figured out. I think we saw on that project that using a Angus bull on a Criollo dam, Angus sire Criollo dam produced a calf that was a little bit growthier, but still had those characteristics of mom. And so now we're creating this F1 cross that kind of has the best of both worlds. So finishes a bit heavier. And there was a feedlot aspect to the project with Texas A&M. So finishing a little bit bigger than just a straight Criollo. So finding that blend of breed, I think that works well. And I think we see that, all over from dairy sheep, goats, of how do we get, solid milking production in some certain climates, right? We need more browse than graze, but still being able to produce pounds that pay, as we say in the reasons world, right?
I'm struck by the similarity in that approach to what we see in dairies here. A lot of dairies are using Angus bulls so that the offspring are marketable, but then they get the lactation of the Holstein too. Very similar approach. Something else I was going to ask about sheep in that regard, and it totally slipped my mind. It'll come back to me. It happens when you get old.
I have a question for you. Are you seeing an integration of more hair sheep and goats, or you guys still see wool sheep on your landscape?
We are seeing more hair sheep, for sure. I think it's kind of a function of the increase in targeted grazing for fuel load out here, and that, even if it's only 4 or 5 days that you got to pull sheep in to get them shorn, that's 4 or 5 days they're not out getting paid. And so we have seen an increase in hair sheep. But we're also seeing a lot of wool sheep being used in targeted grazing situations. We see a lot of our kind of multi-generation folks that have always had Western Whiteface ewes starting to do solar grazing or fuel reduction work or those types of things, grazing in vineyards as well. We're seeing an increase in goats. And I think, it used to be in my part of the Sierra Nevada, there were kind of between here and where I grew up, which is 5 counties away, I'll bet there were 50 or 60,000 Angora goats at one time. And that's really disappeared. It's almost all meat goats now. But definitely an increase in goats and a lot of interest in goats as well. Yeah. Are you seeing hair sheep in your part of the world much?
We have some, thank goodness, we still have a little bit of a colder climate, so our wool sheep do perform well. But yeah, they're out and about. We had some at the ewe sale this year in Montana, and looking at how that works, they can run them together.
We've got this kind of odd gradient in California where we've got parts of the state that are dry and so really conducive to fine wool sheep. And then like my part of the state, we're just across that line in terms of annual moisture where I can't really run fine wool sheep successfully. And there's a lot of coarse wool on the North Coast and in my part of the foothills too. So trying to
What
figure
breed do you
out.
have?
The typical coarse wools are more kind of Dorsets. There are a lot of blackface sheep over on the coast. There are some British coarse wool breeds, Cheviots and some of those breeds on the North Coast as well. Our sheep are blue-faced Leicester crosses and Shropshire crosses primarily. So definitely coarser wool. The shearer likes them because they go really quick to shear them, but be
It's
nice.
all about keeping your shearer happy.
Exactly. All right, so are there many sheep in the Southwest anymore? Did when you were down there, did you work with any sheep at all, or did you see sheep operations?
I didn't work with any sheep, and certainly there are some. I have a really good friend that runs some Churro sheep, and so we still see some. There's a good amount of churros in the Southwest, I would say. And they're keeping that heritage breed, and that's kind of what we call those criollo, the heritage breed, less human influence. And they seem to perform well. They're much smaller. They're looking for a market for their wool as well.
I
But
have
I didn't see as many down, like, say, Las Cruces area, Chihuahuan Desert.
I heard a rumor that the Jornada may be getting into sheep, which I think would be very cool. It'd be very cool. That'd be
How
a
is it?
different kind of sheep operation for sure.
I wonder if they only knew someone down there that knew something about sheep that could help them out.
I wonder if there might be somebody that could consult on that, right? Yeah, so for listeners who don't know, I have a connection to Las Cruces too. My oldest daughter Laura works at the Jornada and works on the same project. Did you guys were you there while she was there?
We passed each other. I think she left Montana State and went to New Mexico, and I went to Montana
We
State. So,
probably passed on I-25, right? So you've been involved in Society for Range Management quite a bit too, right?
I
And
have. Yeah,
tell me more about that.
this past year, I was the Young Professionals Conclave president, and we put on a really great. We've been, we call it YPC. We do a fundraiser with a Wild Rag, and we put on an event called Bridging the Gap, working with mentors and mentees. We do a young producer forum to get kind of that younger mindset out there and try to really be assets for those high schoolers and college kids that are at the Society of Range Management Conference. Something really cool about that conference is there's events for high schoolers and events for college kids, and so it's a great opportunity to take us that are, maybe, I think right now we have it as 5 years into your profession. We're thinking about changing that to really include a wider range of people, but either you're in grad school or you're kind of new in your career, and talking about how we got where we are and being able to be that link. So it's been really fun. It's a great opportunity. I've just loved it. There was a really cool story, and I tell this one often, but I showed up to Fort Ellis in Bozeman to see like what that ranch looked like and where we would be living. And the kid that's living in the house that we moved into, who says I kicked him out, but I didn't. He knew. He was in YPC also, and so it ended up being like, oh, hey, I know who you are, and like, yeah, come on in and check it out. And so the really cool thing about the Young Professionals Conclave, it allows you to get out of just your state or your school and really meet people all over that are doing land management, land stewardship, sorts of different things like that. So
So as a young woman in the range and range livestock profession, what are some of the barriers that you've either encountered or that you think we need to work on, both in the ranching community and in the range community, to get more perspectives and more people interested in doing this sort of work?
yeah, I'll start with, we have our agency folks and our long list of specific classes and credits. I know I went cross-eyed trying to get 4 credits in soil and 3 credits in plant ID with the right lab and the right title. So I think we need to really think about, how we're doing our hiring, continuing to be active in those range clubs in the universities. I think there's a great opportunity right now for young people and young women all the same to be involved in ranching. I feel that we're welcomed and can play to our expertise of whether that's attention to detail or high level of animal care. And there's so many things that we can learn, but continuing to really educate all of our natural resource professions on that integration of livestock and agriculture and why it's important that we have a sense of where our food comes from and continue raising food, livestock specifically on federal and state lands. I know my uncle will tell a story that he had asked a Forest Service person, what who they worked for, and they said the Forest Service. And he says, well, you're a branch of the United States, the Department of Agriculture. And so we actually are all one and the same. And so just making sure that we take into account all the different range or natural resource management that we can to continue to have productive rangelands. And, we always say no management is a management decision.
Right, exactly. I that kind of brings us back to the whole climate discussion. One of the things that I ponder a lot with respect to rangeland agriculture is that there's a huge part of this planet where we couldn't cultivate crops, but we can grow grass, or we can grow other forage species. We can grow brush. Mother Nature grows the grass and the brush with our help, right? So I guess part of the question I have in terms of our approach to the climate question is, we seem to be almost embarrassed about how inefficient we are, how much land it takes to raise a cow or raise a group of sheep. Maybe that's our asset. Maybe that's why we're so important, right? That we keep those landscapes intact because there's a ranching activity going on with them. Does
Yeah,
that
that's
play
key.
into your work with the climate work that you do?
Yeah, it does. We're always kind of thinking about that upcycle, like you were saying. We're taking a blade of grass and producing it into a pound of meat, and that's really exciting. Nutrient dense, fabulous resource for us to consume. And we do need these intact ecosystems for wildlife habitat and, water filtration, soil health, all of our big kind of key terms these days. And so, if we can, my main goal is to keep producers on the landscape. And so, whether that's providing opportunities through grant programs or hopefully applicable research, or just, a helping hand changing water or something like that. It's sometimes filling that labor gap is really what they need. And so continuing opening up markets, right? Whether that's direct to consumer meat or fiber, but continuing to just educate all the people that now that it's a cool thing to live in the country, and some of us have wanted and been there for a long time. You know, how do we all kind of be able to play to each other's strong suits and think that our mindsets don't have to be the same, but we can probably somewhere along the line find a common ground where we can move forward to manage, whether that's multi-use or you know, wildlife habitat and livestock integration.
I, you know, the fact that the wool socks I'm wearing today were, you know, 2 or 3 years ago were just grass and water and sunshine is a pretty cool story too, right? Pretty
Yeah,
cool.
that's the best way I've heard it put. I like that.
One of the questions I've always had about wool, and that this is probably more about my lack of fashion sense, but I have Pendleton shirts that are older than I am. And I think all of us that have been around wool have those things that were handed down, right? Which means I don't have to buy them as often as I'd have to buy a cotton shirt or a synthetic shirt, right? Wool lasts. Is that a strength for us, or is that a challenge in terms of building a market?
I think that's a strength. We have that going for us, but it's that mindset switch from our fast fashion to style. So when we switch from wanting to wear what's trendy and cool to wearing what's going to last and provide us different weather wicking and temperature, and you know, I think we can really play to that. It's great that they've been passed down. I'm sure they're a little itchy. But you know, we're changing that mindset as well as we learn more about how we can blend fibers of natural options, and really just switching the younger people to wanting to wear wool and looking for that. And I think we're seeing that, you know, when I got out of school, which wasn't even very long ago, and I went to go work at the feedlot, people said, "Well, what do you use a sheep for?" And I was in an outdoorsy community. I'm like, "Well, what do you ski in?" "Well, my smart wool socks." And I was like, "So your wool socks, like you said, started out as sunshine, a blade of grass, and a drop of water, but also came from a sheep." And so just educating on that, like we start basic, that wool does come from sheep.
Stuff that we take for granted, right? Because we've seen the whole process, and not very many people get to see that whole process.
And I'll even say, as someone that had seen the process and been around it my entire life, it was a switch when I started thinking about textiles and the end user, and really thinking about the brands. I think on a producer side, you can kind of get tunnel visioned on, you know, sorting it properly, classing low veg, and getting a good price with the low micron. And then you are like, cool, I sold it. And I'm good, and just really thinking about that whole product and getting it back to that textile.
That I, you know, I th that's I hadn't thought of it in those lines. I think we've done a great job of trying to invite chefs, for example, to come out and visit the ranch, or invite a fashion designer to come see the sheep being shorn. It'd be really cool to get ranchers to go understand that other end of the whole product line, right? And see what it takes to actually get a lamb chop on somebody's plate, or see what it takes to get fabric woven and sewn into a garment and sold to somebody that's going to use it. Be a great connection to try to make. So your family was in sheep and cattle both? Did you grow up with both?
We did. I was the summer ranch kid. So wasn't there full time, but we still have sheep, which is really cool. Graze them on, you know, high elevation, high country type situations with sheep herders, dogs, and wagons throughout Wyoming. And so it's an exciting aspect that I hope to keep alive.
There was a
Just
tradition of bass herders in Wyoming, just like there was here in California, right?
yep, exactly. Yeah, they all kind of went, seems like they went to the same towns and worked on the same outfits, and then just stuck around because it clicked.
When did your ancestors come to Wyoming?
It was my grandmother's grandfather.
Okay.
So, yeah. And my grandma and grandpa, they're actually connected to the same town and we're French Basque in the Basque country, Bianco. And and so my mom's 50 or 100%, and so I'm 50% 50% French Basque, and it's a really cool heritage. It's fun being in the range world, especially when you go to Idaho and Nevada. I'm really used to no one knowing what that means and having to pair it with the Pyrenees dogs, or right now the Camino. That's a cool and hip thing in the Basque country. But it does seem our range folks, they're a little more familiar.
Yeah, it does. It does for sure. Was there a tradition of carving in the aspens in Wyoming like there is here too?
Oh yeah, there is. And there's some, I think it's a Johnson County book for Wyoming that has, documented all those really cool kind of county specific books that tracks everyone's family and looks at their aspen carvings. Yeah, it's special. They date back pretty far.
There's some, I've got some research projects in the high country here with livestock guardian dogs and have found several groves that are older trees with pretty cool carvings in them. Pretty neat. What a great tradition. It really is. Well, gosh, this has been great. Is there anything that you wish people knew about what you do that we didn't talk about, Danielle?
No, I think we pretty much covered it. I appreciate the opportunity to share, and I just encourage people to get outside in that natural world and think about where their food comes from, and appreciate the folks that sweat and blood, sweat, and tears their life for you so that we can have nutritious food on our plate and wear, fine articles of clothing.
Sustainable life.
Yeah.
If we have producers in Montana or Wyoming or South Dakota that want to reach out to your program, is there a website that they can access to contact you?
Yeah, we're the fibershedpartnership.org. And so you can track us down there through the Fibershed website or the NCAT and ATRA website.
Great. When we post this, we'll try to share those links as well so folks can contact you for sure.
Great.
We might I didn't get to go to Boise for SRM, but Dr. Haley Wilmer and I conspired to put on a range sheep symposium at Boise, and it might be time to think about doing that again for Spokane. So perhaps we'll need to get together and conspire further about what that could look like.
Oh, I think that would be great.
I think it
Yes,
would be
she did
good.
just text me that she got a big grant for some more grazing, sheep grazing.
So another project that I'm hoping to get her on to talk about, and I'll end this question with this question for you. We're doing a photo voice project where we're asking sheep producers and shepherds to submit three photos about what it means to be a shepherd in the 21st century. And it's been really fun, been a really eye-opening and fun project. But from your perspective, what does it mean to be taking care of sheep in the 21st century?
Good dog. That's timeless. Yeah, or more. So a couple good dogs. And what else would I put in my other two pictures? I don't know how you capture, high level of care and attention to detail, but it really goes in, we're record driven these days, it seems. It's really important. So thinking about your records and reliable pickup, I'd say your dog, your pickup, and
Why is it important to have sheep in the 21st century? It seems like such an ancient way of life.
so that's interesting that you say that. I've realized that recently, actually, there's a hype around traditional cheese making. And I think that range sheep production has that same type of traditional knowledge. It's learnable. I'm not saying you have to come from it to be able to pick it up, but it is a special thing. And so it's important because they operate on the landscape. They have a place there, and I'll always say, right, they're a two crop animal. So very efficient.
I think that's a great place to end. Thank you so much for spending a Friday afternoon on Zoom talking about sheep and rangeland and all the stuff I geek out about anyway. So thank you very much. This is Sheep Stuff You Should Know. We've had Danielle Dunai from the Fiber. Tell us your title again before we sign
We're
off.
the Climate Beneficial Fiber Partnership Project. So kind
Oh.
of a mouthful, but really encompasses it all. And it's been great to be here. This is what I love to talk about and do, so I appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you so much, and we'll see everybody next time.